Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, CEOs, founders and clinicians who are changing the landscape of healthcare in the UK and beyond. Regular listeners will know that I am a CEO and founder myself of a business called PocDoc in the healthcare space. Our Healthy Heart Check is now the flagship health check across the UK. So if you're worried about your heart health, in 9 minutes, the PocDoc Healthy Heart Check can tell you your risk of having a heart attack or stroke. It's available on the high street and in many areas available on the NHS. If you'd like more information, please head to PocDoc.co, P-O-C-D-O-C.co. And thank you very much, as ever, to PocDoc for supporting the show. Thank you also to everyone who's listening live on the amazing UK Health Radio. Thank you for joining. Thank you for being here. Our listenership continues to grow. Johan and his team do a fantastic job on the station. And if you have the opportunity to listen to any of the other people doing their shows, completely recommend it. The other thing that I always say thank you to everyone listening on the podcast channels. We're available on your podcast channel of choice. So thanks for joining. Again, we get downloads now from people in over 50 countries a month, which blows my mind, which is absolutely amazing. And thank you also if you're looking at this on any of the socials or YouTube. So any of the long form or the short form. So that's either on our YouTube channel, which is Health Tech Hour, or on my own Instagram channel, which is at Steve Roost. So all the thank yous out the way. On to today's show. On today's show, we return to the area of mental health, and we're taking a really interesting view of this, which is there's a company that's on today's show. Dr. Melinda Rees is the CEO of a company called Psyomics. That's P-S-Y-O-M-I-C-S, Psyomics.
Well done.
Which is another Cambridge-based business like PocDoc. And actually, weirdly, we actually were probably a couple of hundred meters away from each other when we first started life out on the Cambridge Science Park. Shout out Cambridge Science Park. And they have a really interesting model. So there's quite a few mental health plays out there that are, I would say, more focused on the triage space, but there are very, very few, if any, that have managed to combine that with a biotechnology approach to actually have an accompanying blood-based diagnostic. Now, I know that's a bit of a mouthful, we'll get into it. Basically, Psyomics has a mental health triage and assessment platform and has combined that for bipolar disease with a unique biomarker test. So quite a lot to get into, but Dr. Melinda, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really good. The sun's out. What's more to ask?
Exactly. Now, are you okay with Melinda, or you want the full Dr. Melinda?
Melinda.
Okay, the full doctor. Okay. So, look, again, thanks for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. Why don't we kick off with that? What was your journey like into the entire area of mental health? Like, how did that kind of evolve?
Well, it's first of all to say it's quite a long time ago.
Well, that's okay.
I think it might be 35 years ago. I, as a young person, was really interested in psychology. I studied psychology. I thought I was going to work in the area of human rights and took myself off to work in Nigeria. It's a long story.
Okay. Might be another podcast.
Another podcast.
Yeah.
A whole book, I think. And I, through the course of setting up a community mental health program in eastern Nigeria, found out that a family member was really ill. So I came back to the UK to support my family. I thought it might be temporary, took a research job to pay the rent, and ended up becoming more and more and more interested in psychology, and then put myself forward for clinical psychology training. But I do think the whole thing was triggered by the family member's illness.
And interestingly, when you were in Nigeria, what were the mental health issues that were being addressed in that program? Super interested.
Gosh. I mean, it was...
Because that was quite a while ago, no offense.
Fascinating.
And it must have been like quite at the beginning of well, not at the beginning, but quite early in the sort of trending towards focusing more on mental health.
Yeah, yeah. There's an eminent Nigerian psychiatrist whose name I won't remember, who set up a model of treatment in Nigeria where you bring the community back together around the patient.
Okay.
And of course, they don't use the word patient.
No.
And what tended to happen in those days was when people had serious mental illness, they'd be rejected from their village.
Stigma.
Stigma, and left by the road to die because people were terrified of them. And so the idea of the community that I was working for was to bring a community of people who'd been rejected together with a community of workers, and then recontact the original communities of these people and work to integrate that person back into their own real community over time. And it works.
Right. Yeah.
It really does work.
Is that a model that has since been further validated in lots of different places?
I can't answer that question. I don't know, but I do know it's still ongoing in Nigeria.
Oh, wow. The same thing.
Yes.
Oh, that's super cool.
It's a very established community. I'll shout it out if that's okay.
Yeah, do it.
It's called Amudo, which is spelled, I'll spell it, A-M-A-U-D-O.
Cool.
And that means Village of Peace. And
that's
it's
awesome.
An astonishing project. It was founded by a whole bunch of people. I wasn't one of them. I just joined the party.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. And so you were a researcher. And what was that journey like into, presumably from research at some point, into the world of business?
God. Well,
like, how did that kind of happen?
So there's been a few steps in between. So research, clinical psychology training, which is 3 years.
Yeah.
With it's very applied, the training, so academic and applied. So you get your first exposure to patients through the National Health Service. And then I worked for 20 years in the National Health Service.
In a particular area or patient group
I started out in primary care doing everything and anything to do with psychology and mental ill health.
Okay.
But actually specifically with people that were homeless, addicted to drugs, or asylum seeking. And that was in Newham, and that was an innovative project.
Which is East London, is it not?
It's East London, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm very London-centric, yeah, so that's a good call out. And I grew that service across the whole of Newham over time with lots of team members and colleagues.
And was that quite a unique program at the time? Like, was that quite forward thinking of them?
Yeah. So the Primary Care Trust at the time had special funding to do this as a model and see if it would work in Newham.
Okay.
And then roll it out across other parts of the UK.
Okay.
And I think it was quite successful. It wasn't all easy. But no. I think it was quite successful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I loved working within a primary care team. And then I was backed up by the psychology service.
And for everyone, because we're a broad church, primary care is basically GP adjacent, isn't it? Anything in and around the surgery or connected to the surgery
community.
Or in the community, basically. Anything outside the hospital, broadly.
Yeah.
So there was all of that, and that sounded like it was going really well, you know, so you could have continued on doing that.
Yeah. And then I decided to top up my clinical training because there was a new thing on the horizon called IAPT, which is Increasing Access to Psychological Therapies.
Okay.
Which is now called Talking Therapies, which is the kind of the biggest mental health model in the UK. Talking therapies.
So as opposed to what? Like what? Where were we before talking therapy?
I don't know why they called it that.
Really? Because isn't it? Yeah, how?
I do know why they called it Increasing Access to Psychological Therapies in the first place. So that the idea for that was that GPs could more easily refer people with depression and anxiety to mental health services that were primary care and community-based, rather than going into a secondary mental health trust with all the worry and stigma around that.
And that's quite hardcore, some of those pathways, if you go into a mental health trust.
It's a longer-term relationship normally.
Sure.
So IAPT was being piloted in my area in Newham separately to our service, and I thought it would look really interesting. I was also really curious about the fact that everybody was throwing rocks at it, saying it's rubbish, it's never going to work.
Any basis for that? Or no?
Just tribal behavior, I think, really.
Yeah.
And so I went off and did the specialist training for the IAP service, which, to be fair, my service funded me to do.
Yeah.
And then by that point, the model had been proven to work and it was being rolled out all over the UK.
Mm.
And I chose to go and work in Camden and Islington in their IAP service, which I did for 5 years.
And what are some of the challenges of delivering mental health services in the community through your long and very extensive experience?
The biggest, my favourite victory was being able to get our team of 80 clinicians into every single GP practice across Islington and Camden. So each practice, GP practice, actually had a psychologist inside the practice doing real life.
And so, were they, presumably, silly question perhaps, they were quite busy, right? They weren't they weren't sat around on their hands. And
they weren't that keen to have us at first.
Really?
Yeah, because we take up space and we have a different model. And
because you need to, it's not a 7 minute appointment, right?
It's not 7 minutes, no. Yeah. So how many patients do we see a day compared to how many they see a day? So there were all sorts of kind of cultural hurdles to get over. But what ended up happening over time was we got to have corridor conversations with GPs who would come out of their, you know, their room and say, "Oh my God, I've just seen this patient. I don't know what to do."
Yeah.
And we would be able to say, "Well, have you thought about this? Would you like me to see the patient?" And so we could do that in the area of mental ill health, but also long-term health conditions became part of the work that we were doing.
Well, because some of that's behavioural, is it?
So much so.
Right. What's a long-term health condition for all of our listeners?
So diabetes is a brilliant example.
Right.
If you've got type 2 diabetes that you've developed later in life, it might be because your diet's not very good, usually is. You might also be predisposed to it.
Yep, which some people are.
It's really hard to change your behaviour, right? We all are habit-forming people.
Yep.
So you form one habit, you have to undo it and form another one. That requires quite a lot of specialist intervention. Medication compliance as well is another thing we used to get involved with, helping people keep themselves well.
And in your experience, because I don't know, I mean, I've not been completely keeping track of the mental health space because it's not my space, but we've had some amazing guests from that space and specialists on the show. And over the last few years, there seems to be a lot of media attention around the collapse of mental health services, the mental health service crisis, the lack of funding, the huge uptick in youth mental health diagnoses and things like that. And so how much of that do you think is, or do you know, is real versus the media hyping things up? Like, what's your take on this whole mental health service provision within the healthcare system in the UK?
I actually think it's all real.
Wow.
I think we've screwed up our people.
Okay.
I think there are lots of reasons for that, which we could talk about.
Yeah, just have a listen. That's the point.
So kids, 500,000 kids right now on a secondary mental health care waiting list. So that's kids who've gone through the GP or school triage system and have serious, serious mental health problems. Right now, we've got 500,000 kids in the UK on those waiting lists waiting to be seen. And those waiting lists are many years long in some cases.
How long is a waiting list of 500,000 kids? I mean,
there's one area of the UK which I will not name because I've been told this confidentially, but their waiting list is 20 years long.
20 years?
Yeah.
For just
a child
just go over
with
that.
A serious mental health condition.
And what's a serious mental health condition? What does that mean?
To get on the waiting list, the bar is really high these days. So you would have to be, as a kid, maybe. I'll give you an example of somebody that I came across recently.
Sure.
So a 14-year-old young man who's lost both of his parents. He was going to change some of the details here, but let me say he was first in his specialist area of sport in the country and represented the country, and that career was dropped because of COVID. It couldn't happen, so he lost that as well. When one of his parents died, the full-time carer that brought him up also had to leave because that was paid for by the local authority, so he kind of lost three parents. His grandparents are around, but in COVID they had to be isolated because they both got serious health conditions. And that young person, not surprisingly, descended into depression and anxiety, can't leave the house now, and has been taking quite a lot of non-prescription drugs for the last 5 years.
Wow.
And really needs help. Many attempted suicides.
Wow.
So that person still hasn't been seen.
They haven't been seen.
They have not got to the top of the waiting list.
Wow.
Mm.
That brings it home.
Now, luckily, for that sort of person, there are charities around, and there is a bit of a network around that person. So when that young person's ready to accept help, which is a whole other issue.
Yeah.
And it's a very independent, dignified young person who wants to be able to cope
yeah.
and doesn't realise that their life is extremely challenging
yeah.
because it's normal to them.
Yeah.
When that young person's ready, they've had a little bit of help from a bereavement charity.
And what was it like before? So I know over the last few years, there's been a lot of talk about crisis and waiting lists and
When I trained in children's services, children's mental health services, we call CAMHS services.
CAMHS, yep, CAMHS.
When I trained in CAMHS in Islington 30 years ago, I would see children who had behavioural difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, on a daily basis, I might see a child who was one of those kids that pulled the chairs out from under their mates in class.
Okay.
And the teachers are like, this is strange behaviour. Yeah. It's repetitive behaviour. This young child seems to find it funny, doesn't have empathy for the fact that their friend has fallen over and hurt themselves and they keep doing it. Please, can you see them? So that would have been a typical referral 30 years ago.
Okay.
There would also have been some really complex ones.
And how bad was the waiting? Was there a waiting list?
I don't remember a waiting list. No,
wow.
I don't.
And do you think it's a function of increase in demand and or decrease in clinicians?
Yes, also that. So I think stigma has come down.
Yeah,
so
massively.
We're more able to talk and ask for help. I think social media, I'm afraid, has a role to play. We've all developed shorter spans of attention, myself included, because we are training our brains to concentrate harder for less time.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've had COVID. We can't take away the impact that had on young people and their parents. We've got an economic crisis right now.
Mm-hmm.
Every day another friend or relative of mine is being made redundant. So I think we've got a kind of nexus of problems that have culturally come at the same time, and we're human. We react to them.
Yeah, I completely agree, and thank you for the summary. We are going to go for our first commercial break, and then we're going to get back and we're going to transition to talking about psiomics and all the exciting stuff. And I'd love to understand how you, with all of that amazing history of service to the public sector, at what point you decided to kind of jump ship and come over to the dark side, so to speak. But we'll be right back with Dr. Melinda Reese, CEO of Psiomics. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list? Then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
Cappuccino, latte, Americano, flat white, macchiato.
Just imagine, for less than the price of a single cup of coffee out on the high street, you could enjoy an award-winning online magazine every month with up-to-the-minute information on health and healthy lifestyle. Sounds like a good trade-off? Check out Health Triangle magazine on the UKHealthRadio.com website. Just sacrifice a single cup of coffee every month.
Let's all put health first.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to today's show with Dr. Melinda Reese, CEO of Psiomics. It's great to have you on the show. And before the break, we were covering off really a really in-depth deep dive into the kind of current situation that we seem to be facing ourselves in the UK and presumably other countries as well. But we're sort of focused on the UK, but apologies to all the other international listeners. I'm sure, unfortunately, the situation might be...
It's the same everywhere.
Might be the same everywhere. So how, at what point did you encounter PsioMics and why were you interested? Why did you join? Like, what's the kind of origin story of that?
Well, I was coming out of a role in another independent healthcare company. And I was having lunch with a colleague, a kind of work friend. And we were talking about all the projects that he was involved in. And he told me about PsioMics.
Okay.
And I, my ears pricked up and I said, gosh, that sounds interesting. They've got what? And he said, they've got this platform that can triage, assess and diagnose for all adult health, mental health conditions. And I said, you have to be kidding. Why didn't I think of that?
Yeah.
That's such an obvious thing to do. And I was really embarrassed about the fact that I never even had that original idea myself. So I wanted to see the platform and meet the team. So he arranged for me to do that. And I just got more and more and more and more interested. And then it seemed such an obvious thing to do, such an obvious idea. Nobody else had done it. I could just completely see how it would have supported me as a clinician.
So what exactly, let's start with the platform, because there's a number of other things that it, that, that PsioMics is into, including this unique biomarker for bipolar one, which is super interesting. But why is it so interesting and exciting to have this one platform to triage and assess people?
So,
and by we, when we say platform, we mean like a digital, digital service.
It's a web-based platform. So for, first of all, it frees up clinical time for clinicians.
Okay.
So it does that kind of big funnel of information gathering that clinicians do. So when I meet a patient, I would start, you know, at the top of the funnel and ask 5 or 10 questions that would lead me into a particular segment of the funnel. My brain works like an algorithm. All of our brains work the same way, I think.
Well, I mean, give or take.
Different algorithms.
Yeah, different algorithms. That's right.
And that's essentially what our platform does. So it kind of copies what my brain would do as a clinician. And it's been researched and validated and trialed and it's evidence-based. And it sits at the single point of access in currently in mental health services in the NHS, covering about 6 million adults at the current time.
So, like, the idea is that the patient would do this and it saves time for the clinician who would have to do it anyway.
Yes.
And you end up at the same point, but just without needing the clinician time.
You do. Okay. And you end up, moreover, with a report that the clinician hasn't even had to write.
So right.
The patient fills out what feels like a questionnaire in their own time. We find most people fill it out in the evening or overnight.
Right.
Clinicians don't tend to work in the evening.
You know what? I bet you there's also some data that somebody could dig up. Maybe you know it, but you know when you go to the doctor and for your health check or whatever, and they say, oh, so how many units of alcohol do you drink?
And you say,
well, wait, what's the limit at the moment? 14. Okay, 14 then. You know, I wonder, and there's definitely some feedback that we've had at PocDoc around people being more comfortable doing a healthy heart check at home and seeing the results at home because they don't feel like they're going to get badgered.
Yes.
And then they can choose what to do and what content to interact with. Do you reckon there's a bit of that as well?
Absolutely. And we've had patients feed that back to us. Like, they felt more comfortable. They had time to digest things. Nobody was watching them or judging them.
Yeah.
And people even say they feel listened to, which is astonishing because nobody's listening at that point.
Run that past me.
We've had several people say, I felt witnessed and listened to.
Wow.
I think one of the reasons is we've got a qualitative text field so you can type your story.
Oh, okay.
And that gets ported over to the report that the clinician sees.
Okay.
As well as all the other kinds of information that we
Do you know what's interesting about that? It's like, how long does one of these assessments take if you do it like in real life?
Well, if I do it really, really quickly, I can do it in 20 minutes.
Wow, that's
but
quite long.
But if I was going to take my time about it and I wanted to report problems, 40 minutes is our modal response.
And are you writing it by hand?
Typing.
And then you're typing.
Most people do it on their phone, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that
so? It's quite casual.
Is that kosher? Like, how's the where's the information governance on that one?
Absolutely locked out information governance because we work with the NHS.
Yeah.
So every certificate, everything is locked out.
Oh no. Sorry, I thought you meant. I'm sorry. I thought you meant that the standard of care is that clinicians are writing it on their phone.
Oh no.
What you mean is that PsioMics is
the
available.
Patients use their phones.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the report whizzes over to the electronic patient record system.
Cool.
where all our data is kept.
That's
in the
super
NHS.
Cool.
Yeah. And then the clinician opens it up and they have a visual front page report.
And like when you started going around talking to people about this,
yeah,
did anyone push back on it? Because it's like,
oh,
you said,
yeah.
Oh, really? Because it sounds so obvious. So what's the pushback on it?
You're replacing my role.
Really?
Yeah. You can't possibly be as good as me. I mean, I totally get
but
it.
But does it actually conclude, or does it just collate, present, offer some signposting, or does it actually reach a conclusion, your report? Like, what is it?
So,
how far does it go?
It offers validated and reliable measurement.
Okay.
I have to be really clear here because
there's a very specific
that
phrasing.
The clinician is the diagnostic person and it has the clinical opinion and is the clinical wrapper around.
And I think that's really important because there's a separate discussion around use of AI in healthcare, which is not exactly what we're talking about here, but more like digital clinical support.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is not the same as this AI doctor thing where there's an AI chatbot that diagnoses you, right? They're not the same thing
at all. We do have a class 2 medical device
in the making. Okay.
So that's not available at the current time and certainly not in use, but we will
just to clear the regulators.
We are working towards that.
Okay.
And we are only working towards that because some of the market, the people we sell to, are interested in buying that.
Are you allowed to tell us what it does? Or if not, then no worries.
It will be able to give more of a recommendation.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
But so people were genuinely like, this won't make my life any better. This won't improve anything. This is a bad thing.
Yeah. Don't introduce change. Change fatigue.
Yeah.
Clinicians are brilliant and very, very stressed. People won't like tech. They like to sit with me and talk to me face to face. This is how therapy has been.
I love that one. That's
be.
My favorite one. When I mean, we've heard that as well. Yeah. That's my favorite one, which is that, well, patients just won't, they won't want to do this.
Why like, would they want that?
Do you speak for all patients?
Yeah, yeah.
What is the, what's
shall
your,
we,
shall
we
ask them? Shall we have a go and see what happens?
So it's really interesting that you found that too.
Oh yeah. I think all of us, anyone in this, anyone in and around a, and we're not, we have a split. So some of the delivery of the Healthy Heart Check is clinician led, you know, community centers and pharmacies and all those type of things. But a lot of it is done at home and patient led. So we do cater to both. But the self-testing piece, this was pretty early before we had a product out. It was pretty obvious when we got the product out that this was gonna fly. So, but before, I mean, honestly, I had conversations with really senior clinicians who swore blind that patients wouldn't prick their finger and just could not countenance the idea that a patient would prefer to take a half day off work to go to a GP surgery to have a venous blood draw to then come back for a second visit to get the results.
I know, it's
that
tedious.
They would prefer that than pricking their own finger.
Yeah.
And the frustrating thing at that time was there wasn't a lot of data around this area.
No.
You know, and I think for us particularly, we were doing all of our R&D and developing the product right the way through COVID. That was a complete sea change.
Mm.
That just completely blew this, you know, patients won't do anything stuff out of the water.
They have to.
Well, I mean, a finger prick is vastly more, I mean, no one, you know, finger prick is still a finger prick, but it's better than doing the, you know, swab thing that people have to do. So,
and it really doesn't hurt.
No,
it really doesn't.
I mean, different people have, I mean, we have the oldest person that's ever used a Healthy Heart Check was 92, you know, and they, I think the feedback we got from them was like, well, you know, my fingers hurt a little bit, but they're, you know, 92. So maybe
great.
Have thinner skin and things like that. No, it's also all relative versus a venous blood draw, which is quite invasive. So, how did you kind of get past some of those objections?
We found early adopters. So we found clinicians who were interested, who were forward thinking, and a mental health trust that wanted to come on board first.
And what is a mental health trust versus a hospital trust.
Yeah.
We're a broad church, so what is that?
So it's an organisation that has within it teams that are specialist in different mental health presentations.
Okay.
But also kind of work at the more moderate to severe end of mental ill health. So typically you might be referred as a patient to a mental health trust if you were presenting with something that looked like bipolar disorder or an eating disorder or schizophrenia, psychosis, complex personality disorder, complex depression, anxiety.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they're separate to hospital trust. That's not the same
thing.
They
are, which has its pros and cons.
Yeah. Because they're like its own separate unit.
It is, completely. So they're mostly community-based.
Okay.
So it doesn't look like a hospital, but you do have inpatient psychiatric wards as well.
Okay.
And you can find them sometimes on a general hospital site or separately.
Mm.
They're always at the back of the site, sadly.
Yeah.
And you also find what we call psychiatric liaison teams that are provided by the Mental Health Trust, but work into hospitals, acute hospitals, and a lot into emergency departments. So there is some crossover.
And the Psyomics, the triage assessment platform, it saves 20 minutes effectively or 30 minutes of a clinician's time.
Yeah.
What are they doing? What are they then doing with that time?
The clinicians?
Yeah.
Well, in theory, they're seeing more patients.
Well, no, but that's what I mean. Yeah. I'm not trying to catch you out. I'm just checking that is that basically it helps them clear things through.
It helps with efficiency. Yeah. And I think it also helps with the next conversation the clinician has with the patient, because they've got a lovely window onto the patient's perspective of their own.
Yeah.
Without, you know, it's the patient's voice. That's fantastic. Mm. And then they can hone in on bits of the report and say, oh, can we talk about the fact that you've said here that you feel like killing yourself?
Yeah.
And it just gives you permission to go straight in. I mean, obviously sensitively.
That's interesting. So I've spoken to a couple of people. A guy came on the show, Ruan Sean. He was quite early. I can't remember I'll have to check back what the name of the company was. But his thing was like, he'd suffered from poor mental health his whole life, you know, suicide attempts and things like that. And he decided that he was going to focus on trying to solve the issue, which is not quite the same thing, but it seems like it's on the same continuum. I was like, every time you go to see your therapist, you spend half the therapy session updating them on what's happened.
Yes.
So he sort of created a platform where you just update it.
Brilliant.
In between. And then, like you just said, the clinician can go straight in on like, well, it sounds like on Tuesday you had a bit of a tough day.
Yeah.
As opposed to having to do that download.
Yeah.
And you can also write it down in a non-stigmatized way, because it might be in that room that at that point you don't really want to tell the therapist what actually happened, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. And you often find as a therapist that people tell you the most important thing 2 minutes before the end of the session.
Yeah, the Columbo thing, the hand on the door. Just one more thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's super common.
Yeah.
On a Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock. Yeah.
And so how... Because that's not everything that Psyomics does, is it?
No.
Because I remember when to return back to the intro of the show, PocDoc and Psyomics were like 200 yards away from each other in the science park. And you were working on this, there was a PhD, I believe, that was around a unique, groundbreaking blood test, biomarker to be able to differentiate between different types of mental health, which blew me away at the time. Yeah. So is that...
Still blows me
away. Where, so what's going on with that?
So our founder, Professor Sabine Barn, and the co-founding CEO, Dan, were working together on a blood-based dry blood spot biomarker, which was highly concordant with the diagnosis of bipolar disorder. So
What does that mean in broad church language?
It means that it can predict the diagnosis of with accuracy.
And this is or was or will be, where are we with the, this is the first time this can ever be done?
Yes.
This is the first, right?
This is the first time. So it's taken 10 years, as these things do. And they have completed a discovery trial, which is published in 2023 in JAMA. In October, which is a journal, if anybody else wants to go and look at it. And recently they've completed the validation trial. So we are motoring.
And what does it actually, how does it work and what does it show?
So at the moment, what you would do is a pinprick test like yours on essentially a piece of blotting paper.
Yeah.
That you can put that in an envelope, send it to a lab.
Yeah.
So you can access it easily. Lab does its magic, finds a protein called ceramide. Which is very prevalent, and
in individuals who
receive a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And we also at the same time offer the person the patient 7 questions,
okay,
which are validated, clinical, and reliable. And those two things together bring a concordance, so highly accurate prediction of the diagnosis of bipolar disorder.
Wow.
It's not on the market yet. We are still doing all the research, but to have a discovery trial and a validation trial with really, really strong and consistent results means that there's probably something in it.
How good are the results?
Good enough to be published in JAMA.
That's good. Yeah, that's a great. But the idea being that, like, it's pretty good at predicting.
It is. Now, there are always ifs and buts.
Sure. With any diagnostic test,
obviously would need a clinician to oversee.
Well, yeah. Also, with a diagnosis like that, you can't be telling people at home, for taking the test. Bipolar disease.
So it's not on the market right now, but we're looking at multi-site trials across the US, the Middle East, and a couple of other zones at the moment. I've just come back from New Jersey and Philadelphia.
Okay.
And my colleague Rupert, who's our chief commercial officer, has just come back from Saudi Arabia. So we're out there looking for places to trial across different demographies, different populations and ethnicities.
Cool.
The sample that we have at the moment, or the two trials, were largely female. So, I'm not going to claim we know it all.
Do you know what, though? That's a bit unique. Because most, if not all, medical trials are all male.
Yes, historically.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's interesting. Was that deliberate, or that's just the way the dominoes fell?
No, it's just the way that it fell.
Okay, cool. Right, we're going for our last commercial break of this show. We'll be back in 2 minutes with my fantastic guest on today's Health Tech Hour, Dr. Melinda Rees, CEO of Sciomics. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
May I introduce you to Frequency Medicine from BioHealthScan? It's a brilliant new way to achieve optimal personal health safely, scientifically, painlessly. Find out more about our 21-day challenge. Google biohealth-scan.com/21-day-challenge or ukhealthradio.com for details of our amazing 20% discount offer. Discover what you can achieve with BioHealthScan and enjoy a 20% introductory discount into the bargain. BioHealthScan, paving the way to manage your health a better way.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle, and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at UKHealthRadio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tennis Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with the Skin Comfort Formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the last part of this week's show, this week's Health Tech Hour, with my guest, Dr. Melinda Rees. Now, before the CEO of Sciomics, apologies, before the break, we were digging into Sciomics' groundbreaking biomarker to predict bipolar disease, which is amazing. And it sounds like it's been through trials, and that sounds absolutely phenomenal. What's the so what of being able to do that for healthcare systems? Sounds amazing, right? Like, but what's the so what?
Well, to actually, the biggest so what for me, and I think many people, would be the fact that it takes, on average, about 10 years to diagnose bipolar disorder.
10 years?
Yes. Yes.
10 years?
10 years. Now, there are lots of reasons for that. We've got the waiting list that we talked about before.
Yeah.
And by the way, that is a validated finding, and that's an international finding, and it is published and accepted. Oops, I just bashed the mic.
Sorry. No, don't worry, you're good. It's okay.
The other reason, because I got excited.
Yeah.
The other reason it takes a long time is because bipolar 1 disorder is typified by low mood, which looks like major depressive disorder. And then manic episodes, which can look like other things. So they can look like... you know, Melinda hasn't had enough sleep and she's overworking at the moment and she'll crash at some point, which, you know, sometimes also happens.
That's, well, that's kind of underlines your point, right? You don't know what it is.
It can look like ADHD. It can look like personality disorder. It can look like drug use. So you have to watch and wait for quite a long time. And ideally, you catch somebody in a manic episode.
Okay, and then you can determine...
And then you go, aha, right, now I've got evidence right in front of me on it.
Probably quite difficult to catch someone in a manic episode because they're probably not interested in coming to talk to you.
It's the last person they want to see. Because they've got much better things to
do. Yeah, they've got lots of stuff going on,
I think the other thing to say is people with chronic untreatable depression, so those are the people we start to kind of think, what else is going on here? That also takes a long time to establish. Because
it's chronic and untreated.
It's chronic and untreatable, and you've been waiting. I mean, you can probably get medication, SSRIs, from your GP.
What's an SSRI, sorry?
It's the most common medication.
Okay.
And NICE guideline recommended.
For depression?
For depression. So you can probably get that from your GP fairly quickly. But going on to get good cognitive behavioural therapy through the NHS, which is the other NICE recommended treatment, ideally in conjunction with the SSRI, best results, takes time and, you know, the filter is narrow to get through, to get
So you, so this in theory could, or in practice, could help triage, like your other platform, triage bipolar from every other disorder to then be treated more quickly, more efficiently.
So I think there's massive gains for people in the community who might have a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And we probably all know somebody who does, by the way.
You think? What's the incidence?
So the prevalence is like 2% up to, if you look at, if you see this thing as a spectrum like we do often with even autism as a spectrum, you know, you could, I've heard quotes of up to kind of 25, 30%.
So is bipolar, bit of a tangent, is it a spectrum or is it a diagnosis?
I don't know a definitive answer to that question.
Is that really right? Is that right?
I don't know.
Wow. Is that because the science isn't quite in on that question?
I think there'll be lots of opinion on that.
Yeah.
And I think the other really interesting thing about mental illness or the world that I inhabit is that it's more, some people would say it's more of an art than a science. Now, I will outrage some people by saying that. Who would say it's more of a science than an art?
What's more of an art than a science?
The diagnostic area and also the delivery of therapy. It's all...
Is that a bit of a dividing line?
Yeah, it's a massive debate and it's been going on forever. So we have these big tomes called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual.
Okay.
Where you see that, you know, you, in order to get diagnosis of depression, you must meet these criteria for this long, for these reasons. And you learn that by rote as a clinician. And you go and apply it thoroughly in your research.
Yeah.
But in real life, when you're meeting patients... You're not applying it as, you know, definitively.
Okay.
The other interesting thing to know is we revise those guidelines every 5 years. So they're not fixed in stone.
And what data do they use to revise them?
Huge community service.
Oh, so like massive.
Massive.
It's not just like freewheeling.
No.
Okay.
And
stuff.
I'm sure there are lots of committees and scientists publications.
You bet there's a lot of committees. There is going to be a lot of committees.
Lots of systematic reviews.
Okay.
And I'm sure that it's extremely thorough. So I'm not poo-pooing them, but we have multidisciplinary team discussions.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes we don't know what's wrong with people.
You might have overlapping conditions. That must be really confusing.
Yeah,
that might really muddy the water.
And clinical variation in decision-making in mental health is huge. There's so much variation.
And do you have a lot of variation? Is there a lot of variation in what's an acceptable diagnosis or acceptable treatment? Like there is actually actually quite a wide allowable spread.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it is tribal. So when I trained, clinical psychologists and psychiatrists were arch enemies.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that's not helpful. That can't be helpful.
It's ridiculous. it's ridiculous. I don't think we are. It's all about power and hierarchy.
Right.
I don't think we are anymore. I think we've all got over that one. But, you know, there are psychoanalysts, psychodynamic psychotherapists, Bridgerian therapists, Gestalt therapists, cognitive behavioral therapists. There are so many of us, many different parties and tribes you can join.
Okay. Yeah, all with their own kind of view on
what's what. I believe this.
Yeah. So you mentioned psiomics is out there in the US and Middle East and things like that. Like, what's your view on our healthcare system versus other healthcare systems?
Oof.
pros and cons?
I'll tell you some interesting things I've learned in the last couple of weeks.
Do it.
So in the Middle East, there are no political election cycles.
Which
actually creates quite a healthy environment for long-term thinking around illness and prevention.
You can invest for the long term.
You can
because
really
you've got stability, albeit of a autocracy. So, but yes,
exactly.
I
wouldn't like to say, but no. I really wish we didn't have to think about that strategically in this country. So, you know, when I'm going to an investor and saying, please, can you support me to develop this other thing? Mm. We all have to think about, okay, so we've got Labour in government now. What would happen if Conservative got in? Okay, so I have to hedge my bets like this. And it kind of takes away from what you're trying to actually achieve.
Well, I mean, it creates a huge amount of uncertainty. Yeah. And the where I think it flows back to is it creates uncertainty for investment.
Yes.
In those companies because they're like, well, hold up a second, is that going to be flavor of the month?
And, yeah, exactly.
You know, what's going to happen?
And policy.
Yeah.
So we're all waiting for the long-term plan to be released. It's the long-term plan, but will it only be the 3-year, 4-year plan?
But also like the long-term plan, you know, for everyone listening, is that long-term plan is like this kind of grand overarching policy document, which then has to be interpreted locally and things like that. So the pro of the Middle East, for example, is you can get this longevity.
Yeah. Just come back from the US. My God, I'm glad I don't have to pay for health insurance.
Right.
I mean, and the number of people that can't get healthcare free at the point of access like we can. So yes, we have to wait for it. But once you get there, we have amazing clinicians.
Yeah.
So,
do you think that in the UK, there's a little bit about like, we don't know how bad and scary it could be.
We
don't really realize how bad it is
awful.
Out there.
It's awful.
Yeah.
They advertise between television programs all sorts of drugs and treatments that you can go and buy off the shelf in the US. And I was thinking, why do they do this? It's because people don't want to access healthcare directly because they can't afford to. So all of those other companies know that there's a massive market of people who are going to go
because they want to stay
away
from the insurance or the hospital. They just want to self-manage.
So the online
without
pharmacy
pinging the
thing
insurance.
Is massive in the US.
Right.
And it's growing here too. I don't want that in my life. We're very lucky. We are so lucky. If I was going to criticise the NHS, having worked in it for many, many years and being part of it and taking some responsibility for that too, I would say there's a lot of wastage and duplication in our National Health Service.
Which Wes is handling.
Yep. Or, well, we hope.
I hope so.
We hope.
The thing that I heard, so we had Mo from Patients Know Best on the show a few shows ago.
Yeah.
And he obviously he's like captain patient data.
Yeah.
You know, he's literally written multiple books on patient data.
Yeah.
And he was saying that in the US, the hospitals view patients as their customers.
Totally.
So they won't share patient records.
They don't. No.
With anyone outside that hospital.
No.
So even to the extent where new doctors, you move to new areas, you want to choose a new hospital, it's unbelievably difficult to actually get them to share records, which is crazy.
Yeah.
But it is a bit like asking Uber to send Bolt your customer data.
Yeah.
They probably won't do that because they're a private company. So as soon as you let them be private companies, they're going to operate like private companies.
Yeah. And I suppose a good thing about the NHS, we work in the NHS towards giving somebody the least amount of intervention they need to get to the best clinical outcome. That's the principle.
Yep.
In the US, you get paid per clinical contact time with a patient. So you want to see them quite a lot.
Mm.
You'd quite like to keep them in hospital. You're leveraged to keep the patient
there longer. Looking to do other services.
Yeah, stick it, like get the patient to stick to you. And that is at odds with one's clinical training. So that must be really hard as a clinician in the US.
Unless they're, do you think their training is still the way the training is?
Yeah.
And then they hit the reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That must be a real shock to the system.
It's really hard.
Yeah. So what's next for Sciomics? Because we're coming to the end of the show. So tell us what's
next. Okay. So we're building our children's platform.
Oh, wow.
Yep. We're going to deliver that. We've got advanced contracts in the NHS, delivering that in the autumn. We're looking at multi-site trials for the biomarker. We're looking to do our first economic evaluation of our adult mental health platform in a US environment, also in the autumn.
Nice.
And we are really excited, actually, about a whole bunch of conversations we're having in the Middle East.
That's great.
Yeah,
congrats. So, it's all go, go, go.
Yeah, it's go, go, go. It's
congratulations. So two things before we go. One is, what's your view on the real impact of social media on children's mental health?
My personal
Your personal,
view.
Yeah.
I've got three sons. They're 25, 22 and 19. I have struggled as a parent with their journey through using different kinds of social media that have developed a lot over time. And I've watched their developmental cycles. My view is that children are, we are training our children's brains. They can be untrained.
Okay.
So I think we need to hold that in mind, but we need to be really vigilant that concentration is much less good than it used to be. I mean, I'm not saying that's the same for everybody, but we are definitely training our brains. And then there's a whole thing about bullying, which occurs on social media. Mm. And there's, I'm sure, lots of positive stuff too. So I think, and one more thing, there's addiction.
Mm.
So I've used social media to try and teach my kids about addiction at the earliest possible age.
Okay. And what? How does that manifest itself?
I just talk to them and say, "How do you feel when you come off that thing?"
Oh,
I
mean, interesting.
I mean, so they can recognize. They could self-control now.
They could recognize.
Yeah,
I feel
angry,
anxious and
or
angry.
Anxious.
Yeah,
I don't want to. What's this stopping you doing? It's stopping me going out.
Yeah.
In COVID, is this helpful still to you? Yes, because I'm lonely because I can't see my mates. So you know, just talk.
That's amazing. I guess that's why you're a doctor and have done all the stuff you've done.
So poor
that's,
kids, that's, eh?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. cool. And then the last thing, I say this to everybody, obviously you've had this incredible career and now you're doing this incredible business. Mm. What kind of mottos or mantras or phrases do you, I ask this of everyone, I'm not just picking on you. What do you kind of rely on, your internal monologue that gets you through what must have been some very difficult, challenging situations?
Oh, I've got two or three that come to mind. So proceed until apprehended.
I've not heard that one. That's a new one. I love that. Proceed until apprehended.
Yeah, which I have borrowed from one other person.
That's great.
Who used to say that to me 10 years ago in my first startup.
Okay.
This is a bit morbid, but on your deathbed, will you regret doing this or not doing this?
Interesting.
Yeah. And think of a patient that you have seen, Melinda. What's the right thing to do?
Okay.
So I really remain true to my my principles.
As you were trained as a clinician.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. That makes me sound like an absolute angel.
No, well, you know. Anyway, look, Melinda, thank you. Dr. Melinda Rees, thank you so much for coming
on
the show. It's been great to have you on. If people want to learn about Sciomics, where do they go?
It's just to our website.
Which is?
Sciomics.
So that's Sciomics dot something.
com.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week with a new show.